The date is Wednesday, July 13th, 2017. The time is 2:03 p.m. It's a hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. Location is the hearing room located in Suite 1140 North, 441 4th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. We're here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. I'm Chairperson Peter Segedy-Mazak, and I'll serve to chair today's hearing. With me on my right is Commissioner Diana Harris-Epps, and on my left is Commissioner Michael Spencer. We have one argument today, notice for hearing at 2 p.m. regarding the housing accommodation located at 4234 4th Street, Southeast, Unit 301. The tenant petition number is RHTP30764. The case is styled LaShawla Waller and Tyrone Wise, tenants appellants, versus Novo Development Corporation, housing provider appellee. The commission notes there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenants appellants.
Yes, good afternoon. Robert Pfefferman on behalf of the tenant appellant. With me today, to my left, is Tyrone Wise.
Welcome.
How you doing, sir?
And for the housing provider.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Brian Rieger. I represent the appellee.
Thank you, Mr. Rieger. I'd like to briefly explain our procedures. Our rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present your case, beginning with the tenant's appellants. The tenant's appellants may reserve up to 5 minutes of your 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the housing provider appellee. The housing provider appellee must present all of your arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal. In our discretion, the commission will allow additional time for argument in the event that we ask you a number of questions and occupy a substantial portion of your time. Our hearing is recorded on audio CD. Our decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties within 30 to 45 days. In this proceeding, we do not request nor will we accept any pre-hearing submissions from either party. As the clerk of the court noted, please turn off any electronic equipment. In the interest of administrative efficiency and the opportunity for prompt resolution of this dispute, we respectfully ask each party whether or not each of you would regard settlement at this point before we go to hearing as an option. We certainly would encourage that because of the risks of obvious risks of litigation. But we need both parties' consent. If one party does not consent, then it's all game over. We're not going to force it on anyone. We have an extraordinarily experienced and good settlement officer who's here. And what we would do is we would take a recess briefly to allow the settlement officer to meet with each of you and to determine whether or not there might be some opportunity here. We would then, if that's the case, then we would schedule some mediation sessions. This would be on recess. And if we were able to achieve something, then the settlement agreement would be read into the record. If not, we would just continue the hearing at that point. I don't know what the status is of your case, whether or not you've spoken a lot to each other, what the status was of mediation, but this is another opportunity, and the Court of Appeals has done it successfully, and we've done it successfully, too. So, Mr. Rieger, do you have any interest in trying to settle this matter now?
You know, this is the first time it's been approached to us. We actually paid off the amount that was required by us to pay in this agreement. So I'd have to go back to my client at this point. I mean,
I got you. I understand. There's really, in other words, what you're saying is that there's not a whole lot to mediate once you've paid off the judgment below.
Yes, Your Honor.
I got you. And Mr. Pfefferman, how do I pronounce your name, sir?
It's Pfefferman.
Pfefferman. Mr. Pfefferman.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, we would like the opportunity to discuss settlement. We haven't heard a response to our last offer to settle the outstanding claims. So,
Mr. Rieger.
I'm not aware of, I mean, we paid off the the amount here. I'm not sure what he's referring to.
Can you explain what you're referring to? Was there additional monies that you were seeking? Is that correct?
Okay. Yes.
I don't think, from what Mr. Rieger said, that I think he is sad. I think that the satisfaction of the judgment below. I don't want to put words in your mouth, sir, but that's any more additional money on the table that would be requested is not something you would have authority to do right now. But the likelihood, from what I'm hearing, is the likelihood of your client agreeing to that is probably not very high. Am I right on that?
Well,
Want to at least give it a shot?
Sorry. With all due respect to Mr. Pfefferman, I don't remember discussing any further settlement proposals or financial.
Okay. I think there's enough doubt in the air that both parties, usually, if there were an interest, they would exhibit their willingness right away, and we would get to it. This, whenever I sense there's any question, I don't think it's prudent to move forward in that direction. We will therefore proceed to the hearing. And Mr. Pfefferman, would you like to reserve any part of your 20 minutes for rebuttal after Mr. Rieger's presentation?
Just 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, sir. So you'll have 15 minutes then for your initial presentation. And I'm just going to ask you this: Is your child okay? Is she doing okay? Because I don't want to take her away from her dad, so I just want to make sure she's okay.
Is she okay?
Okay. She wants some water or something. We can always get her something. Okay. All righty. Okay, Mr. Pfefferman, 15 minutes.
Okay. Good afternoon. Okay. So, in the notice of appeal, there are sort of specific errors that are noticed that are.
Would you both be so kind as to speak a little louder? Those are only recording devices. They do not elevate your. They don't amplify your voice in any way. And
sure.
You both have kind of these deep voices. It's difficult to
sure.
hear.
So the specific errors of fact and law that are noted in the notice of appeal present following four issues to be decided by the Rental Housing Commission. The first issue is whether the administrative law judge erred in her findings of fact and or conclusions of law when she found that the housing provider had rebutted the presumption by clear and convincing evidence that certain actions taken by the housing provider were not for retaliatory purposes. So the first issue that we'll be dealing with is whether or not the administrative law judge was correct in her ruling that the housing provider had properly rebutted that presumption.
The one when you use the term error, let me just, and I had questions about this, but if we're talking about findings of fact, then essentially what you're alleging is a substantial evidence. If there's not substantial evidence in the record to support that finding of fact, if we're talking about conclusions of law, essentially what I understand you to say is that she misinterpreted the law, or there are legal cases that would support a different interpretation. But one is substantial evidence-based, and the other is really the language of the law itself and whether or not the terms of the act have been violated. Is that your understanding, Mr. Pfefferman?
Yeah, when I'm talking about errors in finding a fact, you're correct in understanding that I'm talking about whether or not the record, that there's substantial evidence in the record to support that finding of fact. When I'm talking about conclusions of law, I'm talking about whether or not some of the findings of fact, whether errors or not, rationally lead to the conclusion.
Okay, so the rational relationship between the finding of fact and the conclusion of law. That's when you when you're talking conclusion of law, that's the kind of nature of the issue you're talking about. Is that a fair restatement of it?
That is a fair restatement, but I would add to it that in some cases when I'm talking about errors in conclusion of law, I'm also talking about the standard of plain error.
All right.
Okay, moving on to the second issue that I would like to raise with the commission, and that is whether or not the administrative law judge erred again on conclusions of law and findings of fact that certain facilities were or were not substantially, well, in this case, were not substantially reduced by substantial and prolonged housing code violations, and specifically, we're talking about her findings of fact in the areas of mold, plumbing leaks, holes and cracks in the walls throughout the apartment, peeling and cracked paint throughout the apartment, broken kitchen cabinets, inoperable doors throughout the unit, and inoperative electrical sockets. The third issue that I'll be raising is whether or not the administrative law judge erred in her finding, in her conclusion of law, that the housing provider had not interfered with a tenant association at the property. And the fourth and final issue that I'll be raising is whether or not the housing provider acted in bad faith. So, standard of review. Let me start with the standard of review.
Let me ask you, just so that we don't have to make this any more difficult. I want to start with number four, treble damages, bad faith. That then goes to the judgment that was awarded. You're saying that the judgment should have been three times the amount of what it was because of her determination. Her determination was that there was no bad faith. Your position is that there was. The other issues you raise really, they go. When I look at the remedy is really a fine. And I'm wondering, are you making the point that she should have assessed fines against the landlord for, or the housing provider for those violations? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, I understand the point that you're making is that that's not a remedy that necessarily affects my client here, and so that's not the main key remedy that we're seeking with the finding of retaliation. But I would say that a finding of retaliation goes hand in hand with a finding of bad faith. And so it would be a little bit out of order for me to discuss my analysis of her errors without first going through retaliation. For me, it would feel like starting backwards to go to bad faith.
I see. So in other words, what you want to do is you want to link bad faith to treble damages. Retaliation to bad faith and therefore to treble damages. That's what you're doing? Is that?
That's correct, but there's also other reasons why I would want a finding of retaliation.
Okay. And were these argued in a reconsideration motion below, too?
They were not.
And can I ask why not? That seems to me that some of these might have been a better, the finder of fact may have been a better determiner of some of these factual issues than we are, because all we have is a cold record that was created below, and if we're on the same record that the judge was below, then we're constrained by that record. There's really no, we can't look beyond it. And so I'm just wondering what the decision was that you didn't, these may have been better raised below than some, arguably one might say.
At the time, it didn't seem like it would be a worthwhile effort to file a motion for reconsideration. It didn't seem like a motion for reconsideration would be granted to me at the time.
Well, if you could, you know, I don't want to cut into your time, but if we could then kind of proceed, just make your major point on each issue, and then my colleagues may have some questions, but my questions are finished, really, so please start.
Well, I'd like to focus on one particular error, and I'll just skip through. I think the Commission understands the standard of review here, and I'll briefly go over a statement of facts and the key timeline leading up to this. So a housing provider first issues a notice to correct or vacate to Mr. Wise on April 7th, 2015. A letter sent to myself sent a letter to Cascade Park Management on April 10th, 2015 that was outlining the housing condition issues at the apartment. On April 24th, 2015, the tenant filed a complaint on the housing condition calendar for abatement of those conditions. On June 8th, the housing case was dismissed and the housing provider was ordered to do further extermination of the property. On June 16th, 2015, the defendant and other residents at Cascade, the tenant and other residents at Cascade formed a tenants association. On July 24th, 2015, the housing provider issued another notice to cure or quit based on this time loud and boisterous behavior. On September 3rd, 2015, the housing provider served a third notice to cure or quit, this time based on auto repairs in the parking lot. On September 9th, 2015, the housing provider filed suit for possession based on the second notice, which was cited loud and boisterous behavior, and this case was dismissed at the first roll call on October 8th, 2015. On October 15th, 2015, the housing provider, they dismissed their case. On October 19th, the tenant filed a second complaint on the housing condition calendars for the abatement of the same conditions that were filed in the first housing conditions calendar case. On November 5th, the housing provider filed their second landlord-tenant case based on the third notice to correct or vacate, which was cited auto repairs in the parking lot. And finally, on December 30, 2015, the tenant filed the pending tenant petition. So the one issue that I would like to focus on here is the administrative law judge's failure to cite any facts in the record whatsoever that would go to the housing provider's rebuttal of the presumption of retaliation in the first landlord-tenant case that the housing provider filed. So here the administrative law judge found correctly that the statutory presumption outlined in 14 DCMR 4304 applied to both landlord-tenant cases that the housing provider filed. And she goes on in her analysis to discuss now the first case. I would remind the commission that the first case is based on loud and boisterous behavior, and the second case in landlord-tenant was based on repairs, auto repairs in the parking lot. The administrative law judge only cites findings of fact in her decision which go to the second landlord-tenant case that is filed. There's absolutely no fact cited which seems to support that there was any evidence presented on the record that would rebut that presumption. There was no evidence presented on the record to rebut the presumption of that applies to the first landlord-tenant case. And there was, in fact, no findings of fact made in the decision in order which would that was cited to that could support that the that the presumption was rebutted.
Can I interrupt you and ask you about what your thoughts are? She made a passing reference in her decision about bad faith. Do you think she gave it a full discussion or applied the appropriate tests? Or do you think that there's evidence in the record she might have overlooked in her discussions?
Yes. I do think there was quite a bit that she overlooked in the record. She didn't take into consideration full testimony from multiple witnesses. There was witnesses, two Metropolitan Police officers testified in that case that the landlord was singling out Mr. Wise above all the other tenants in direct response to the litigation that was happening. All of this was taken on the record, and it's not cited at all in her decision as far as bad faith that was concerned. There's also other things in the record, such as the impeachment of the only witness that the housing provider put forward. The only evidence that the housing provider presented was presented by a witness who was then impeached on the record. I understand that it may go to the weight of the evidence that was presented, but I don't think that the administrative law judge equally weighed the evidence that was presented by the housing provider and by the tenant. There was the hearsay, the housing provider relied on a hearsay document that purported to show incidents where the tenant was observed working on cars in the parking lot. She weighed that evidence much heavier than she weighed evidence from the Metropolitan Police officers who testified that to the things that the security officers said specifically to those officers about retaliation that was happening on the property.
With regard to the bug infestation and the rodent problems, there was some information in the record that when DCRA issued a notice after they'd inspected, indicating essentially to the housing provider that it was an ongoing infestation and they were to continue to abate it through best efforts. Was there any indication, or is it your theory, that their failure to take the appropriate steps or the timing in any way is in any way evidence of bad faith, or was there any indication or your thoughts that independent of the notice from DCRA that your client had a responsibility to then independently also inform the housing provider that either the rodents and the infestation was ongoing?
Right. The administrative law judge did not take into account a lot of the testimony that the tenant gave regarding when notice was given to the landlord, when complaints were made about certain conditions there, bed bugs and roach and mice infestation.
Do you recall whether she made any findings of fact with regard to the issue of notice as it relates to the issue of bad faith? I didn't find any.
I don't think so, no.
Please continue.
Okay.
So you have a couple of minutes left, so
I see.
Just want to let you know.
I see. So regarding the conclusions of law, that whether there were conditions in the apartment that were substantially reduced, she didn't take into account the notice issue, and she found on each conditions that she ruled against that there was no evidence on the extent and duration of the condition. But that just isn't so. There was for the punch out list items specifically, where she found that these items were listed on the punch out list, that alone would give notice as to the duration of the condition, and didn't take into account any of the testimony that the tenants gave about follow-ups on those repairs. She just simply said for each condition that there was no evidence of extent or duration and does not accurately reflect what was put into the record.
So what, summarizing, can you summarize like the major, what you perceive to be the, you know, the critical error, and forget, you know, we understand the standard, but just Commissioner Epps suggested one was noticed with respect to the treble damages issue with respect to the, was it the
infestation.
So that's one, but is there anything else that you would like to highlight?
The fact that she wasn't able to find
Let me ask you this. I'm a little, and I'll give you an extra minute or two on this. It appears to me sometimes what you're contesting is her determination of evidentiary issues below, and your claim that a particular finding wasn't based on substantial evidence in the record because there was a lot of countervailing evidence that she didn't consider. Okay. The standard we have is, as long as her decision is based on substantial evidence, there may be substantial evidence to support other positions too. But so long as there is substantial evidence in the record to support her position, that's what we're looking at, despite the fact that there may be substantial evidence to support other interpretations. And so I'm just wondering, is what you're saying is that they didn't meet that threshold of preponderance to support a finding of fact?
I think absolutely they did not.
Okay,
and I think
that's good to know. And then the conclusion of law issue is that because they didn't, a conclusion of law based on that evidence would be unsupportable because the evidentiary basis of it would be insufficient.
Right.
Is that a fair way of putting it?
That is a fair way of putting it. And I would say I think it's appropriate to say that it was abuse of discretion in the way that she interpreted the evidence that was presented to her. For example,
just one more minute.
Okay. I have a question.
And then I'll let you.
For example, I would just point to one finding of fact that she made. I believe it was paragraph 19 of her findings of fact, which is. No, I'm sorry. This is at one point she makes a finding of fact that there was Mr. Wise. Here it is, on number 63. It says finding of fact here, which is plainly just incorrect on the face. It says that there was on June 1st, 2016, a recently installed security camera recorded Mr. Wise working on cars in the parking lot. They presented in Respondents Exhibit 204, a picture of somebody in the parking lot doing something that was neither Mr. Wise nor was the person working on cars. And they said that there was a video of this incident happening. No video was produced. I think that, you know, this was just
understood.
Just totally ignored. And
understood. And Commissioner Epps?
So I'm trying to understand how the Rental Housing Commission can address the point that you bring up about Mr. Wise feeling that he'd been pushed out of a complex essentially by the housing providers based on his community involvement, and whether that is or is not the case, but what type of assistance are we able to, in our review posture, able to assist? What are you seeking with that?
You're referring to notice of appeal. So I think this is, goes back to why I would like a finding of retaliation. The housing provider has acted with impunity in its actions towards Mr. Wise and has gotten away with it in the finding that was issued by this administrative law judge. I think this is a person that's a member of the community who is supportive of the community, who is helpful there at Cascade Park, where there's not a lot of people that are helpful. And instead of supporting that kind of work, the housing provider, and this is, I don't know, but it seems like the housing provider takes it as a threat or is targeting him specifically because of those reasons.
Okay.
And a finding of retaliation, I think, would at least, it would at least be a finding that's on the record and we could use.
So that's the type of thing you're seeking for that?
That's one of the reasons why I'm seeking retaliation.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Spencer?
No questions.
Mr. Rieger, you have 5 minutes, sir, after Mr. Rieger, okay? Now, we'll give Mr. Rieger enough time, sir, so you're not constrained to 20 minutes. You will probably have some questions, so.
I have an initial question.
Sure.
I'm new to this process, but on quite often, the council representing the housing provider seem surprised or taken aback by our question about the potential of settlement. So my question is that in preparation for hearings before us, is it that we're not doing a good job communicating to housing providers, council, that you're going to be queried that way such that you would be prepared to be able to respond, as opposed to what seems to be often the standard response from housing council, is that surprise that we are partaking in the same things that they do in all the other judicial bodies here, having worked in a few, and that you would not have in advance of today called your client to inquire, well, you know they're going to ask, and what is your response? So is it that we're not providing that notice to you in advance of coming here today, or that perhaps you, in the Court of Appeals, you're not familiar with that practice, or in D.C. Superior Court, you're equally not familiar with that practice? And that's my question.
Okay. My response is that I know they've instituted mediation in the Court of Appeals, but for better or for worse, I haven't had any Court of Appeals arguments lately. I am a practicing attorney in Superior Court, and we go through mediation all the time. But I was not aware, and I recently had a hearing here, but the other side didn't show up, so the question wasn't raised. But this, I was not prepared and had no notice that you would be asking about this. And had I known about it, I would have contacted my client to see whether there's any interest. So
when we queried you right now, that's the first time you kind of became aware of this practice?
Yes.
Very well. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank
you. Please go ahead.
Okay. Our position and my personal position is that we're in a severe disadvantage today. Mr. Pfefferman, on behalf of his clients, filed a notice of appeal back in October, and he raised certain points, I expected that he was going to either file a motion for reconsideration, as Your Honor suggested, or at least file a brief after he got the notice, so we would know what law he was citing that would support his positions, and that I could research and find out whether he had any validity to his points. But he didn't do that. So I'm here, my position is that we have a over 40-page decision from Judge Yonner. She spent over 2 days in this proceeding. There was many, many exhibits presented to the court. There was much testimony. She had the opportunity to review the witnesses, review the exhibits, and we believe that although we were found to have done something wrong, we believe it was a valid decision. And I'm not sure how this commission has a basis for overturning the decision. What he's asking you right now is to sit in her place and almost hear everything all over again and become the finders of fact. And I don't think that's your position, your place, and we have nothing, no law to support no sites to support his position. I don't.
Were you the attorney below for the housing provider?
Yes.
So, I guess, interpreting what you just said is that if we interpret Mr. Pfefferman's two types of determinations, one factual, that is substantial evidence, your position would be the record speaks for itself. There's substantial evidence to support every factual finding that she made.
Yes.
And if he gets specific about, for example, the one, the failure to provide a video record of Mr. Rice's... Mr. Wise's working on his car in the parking lot, and there's no evidence of that. Your position is, well, to the contrary, there was evidence to support that factual determination.
Yes, there was photographs given. There was testimony by our witness, who was a property manager at the time, who testified about Mr. Wise working on the cars at that time period.
Okay. I think that Mr. Rieger, is all you can basically say. I mean, unless we go point by point by point, and then it's a question of we're then weighing evidence. We can't put ourselves in the position of the trial judge. You know, we have to look at the whole record and see if there's substantial evidence to support the determination. But your point on the factual question would be there was substantial evidence
Correct.
In the record, and the fact that the judge credited certain evidence, didn't credit others, is her entirely within her discretion as a trial judge.
Yes.
And there, contrary to what Mr. Pfefferman said, you did not view it as an abuse of discretion. She was merely an exercise, a legitimate exercise of her discretion at that level.
But,
now, a more interesting question to me is what Mr. Pfefferman said with respect to the rational relationship between the conclusions of law and the findings of fact. Your position would be that the findings of fact supported every conclusion of law. If you take a look at the conclusions of law, that there was a rational relationship, the judge didn't go off the reservation, off the record, shall we say, to make determinations of law. Every determination of law had a rational relationship to findings of fact that were in the record. I think that would be your position.
Exactly.
As I understand.
Exactly.
Trying to, as you said, trying to make, these are the legal standards we have to apply, you know, when we look at this, Mr. Pfefferman, too. We're not here to retry this case. You know, we're here to look at the record and say, did the determinations, the conclusions of law, were they supported rationally by factual, by a preponderance of the evidence below? And there may be a preponderance of evidence to support other things, but so long as there's a preponderance to support, and we have to view it as substantial evidence to support the court, then that's, regardless of whatever other evidence there may be, that's what we look at. So
you've taken the words right out of
I didn't mean to make your argument
no,
for you, but I'm again, when you have a notice of appeal that uses the term error without putting the legal standard in, I just want to make clear to you what legal standards we would use to assess what you mean by error. Okay, that's all I was trying to do. But I didn't want to also, if my colleagues have questions.
I did.
Yeah.
So is it your contention somewhere within her conclusion she actually gives a full discussion of bad faith and goes through the prongs and indicates that she made findings of fact and conclusions of law with regard to notice that your client either was or was not on notice, and so because they were not, or that she even discusses whether the tenant met his burden with regard to bad faith? Because if it's there, I can't quite see that. I mean, I know that it was 40 pages, but 40 pages does not necessarily mean that she actually discussed or supported her conclusions in any way by any of the just because there's 63 findings of fact, that does not mean that everything was there. And so I know it's a very long discussion, and perhaps some things might have gotten missed, but I would really like to know your thoughts about whether she adequately discussed whether there was bad faith.
Well, if you go through each of her discussions with regard to alleged defects in the apartment, she states after each paragraph that there was either no or not specific enough evidence about duration or the extent of the property.
So let's talk about when she makes this determination that there was not sufficient information about duration. Does she even point to what finds of fact she made with regard to the issue of duration, or does she just kind of make these conclusory statements? Because it's fine to make a conclusory statement and then you draw it back to some findings of fact, but I was having a hard time kind of seeing where she was, like, there's not enough information. Did she make a finding of fact at all about duration?
Well, all I can say is, had you been at the hearing, you would have supported what she was saying, because there was not sufficient testimony about duration of anything. That was one of the things that I kept pointing out as we went through the testimony there, that it was, with all due respect to Mr. Pfefferman and his clients, they didn't put on a very good case.
Okay.
And there wasn't much for her to work with there.
Okay.
So she dealt with it and was put in words what actually took place there. And they did not give the information for her to make that determination. And therefore, her conclusions at the end of those paragraphs were proper in light of the testimony that was...
Was my understanding is that there was some documentary evidence submitted as well. And I don't see where she refers to that at all. Perhaps she just didn't credit it?
I don't think she credited a lot of documentary evidence because they didn't support the conclusions that were given either by the testimony or by argument.
I can't quite tell whether she did or she didn't, because she doesn't really make any reference to it at all.
Well, I think throughout she talks about the fact that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support the claims of the tenants in this situation. I felt that when reading this, and I read it again last night, I thought she gave a very thorough discussion of what took place at the hearing, having sat through the hearing myself. So, and in light of the fact that she still found that my client owed the defendant some money, in light of all that happened there at the hearing, I thought it was a well-written and well-founded decision.
I just couldn't see where she had any specific findings with regard to any type of notice with regard to anything in particular.
Because there was a lack of testimony about notice throughout the hearing. And that we seized upon that in our discussions and our arguments. And I think that was clear throughout the proceedings.
So rather than kind of... indicate that some of the documentary evidence could have been perceived as notice, she just seemingly ignored any documentary evidence that could have been led to notice.
The only documentary evidence that was really presented was the punch list and then the couple of notices from Inspector Science Sticker.
Mm-hmm.
And she dealt with that and talked about that. So there really wasn't other documentary evidence which showed either duration or notice to the landlord.
And what about the issue of retaliation? Do you think that was even addressed or raised below, such that she should have addressed it differently or even at all?
I think she dealt with it based on all the information and all the testimony that was given to her, that there wasn't a clear basis for saying that there was retaliation there. The issue was raised. We had testimony showing that, which we rebutted it by, we believe, clear and convincing evidence that there was no act of retaliation. She dealt with...
And she applied the right standards.
Yes, I certainly believe she applied the right standard with regard to that.
With regard to both bad faith and...
Yes.
So in other words, I think what my colleague is saying, if say broken or inoperable doors, including the front door, last two sentences, there was no evidence about the extent or duration of any problem, I conclude that services were not substantially reduced. She says that about a lot of these. In other words, the last two sentences of each of these paragraphs is there was no evidence about the extent or duration of any problem. Your point is that had there been, that there was no evidence about it, and so and if there was, she simply didn't credit it. That's your point, right?
Mostly that there was not evidence about duration or extent, and therefore she could not give enough weight to it to make a finding that there was...
Were treble damages raised below? Was the whole issue of bad faith raised below at all? Or was this an issue that arose on appeal rather than at the hearing? Because a judge isn't under any compunction without a party raising the issue to raise it sua sponte. So I'm inquiring whether the issues my colleague is talking about were even raised or whether or not...
Because she seems to kind of not give a full discussion of that, so I'm not sure.
Well, the issue of retaliation was raised below.
I'm talking about treble damages, really. I mean, there is no onus on the court to say, by the way, I'm assessing treble damages because if no party raises it, then it's not an issue before the court, unless it's would be a gross miscarriage of justice not to do it. We don't do that with treble damages. It's typically raised by a party, but to your knowledge, was the issue of treble damages raised below? I'm just asking, but to your immediate recollection, it wasn't clearly raised.
And I'm not going to say that because I just don't remember.
Okay.
We spent so much time in this hearing and we go back to September, so, and at my age it's hard to say I can remember or not, so I don't want to give
that
a false answer. I just don't remember.
Yeah. Well, we can ask Mr. Pfeffer, and I'm certain I know what the answer for Mr. Pfeffer would be. In other words, do you have any questions, Commissioner?
No.
Commissioner, do you have any? Please, further, if you have more questions, absolutely.
We do have the ability, however, to go back and looking at what happened at the hearing, we do have the ability to determine that when there were statements that there was no evidence as opposed to there was evidence in concluding it of whatever value. I mean, there's one thing to say that there was this evidence and I find that it didn't have any value as opposed to just, you know, giving more of kind of a more thoughtful conversation about what was being said. I mean, your comments about the quality of the proof presented could easily been articulated as opposed to just saying no evidence. So there could have been some information that she just chose not to weigh or weighed it differently, which could have given us a clearer understanding of why she came to the decision that she made. But with regard to the issue of retaliation and the issue of being... feeling pushed out, what's your thought about the evidence that was presented at the hearing with regard to those issues?
Well, with retaliation, there was the discussion about the notices and whether we had a valid basis for serving those notices. And so there was clear testimony about that. I don't remember any testimony about being pushed out. So, again, I'm not sure where that comes from a appellant in this situation, and so I'm not sure how to answer that.
Very well.
I mean, it may have gone along with the idea that there was retaliation against the tenants, but I don't think it was anything that was actually separate and apart from that idea that they believe that there was retaliation, and we had the opportunity to rebut that, and I believe we rebutted that by clear and convincing evidence. So I don't think being pushed out was, if it was raised, it was separate and apart from the idea that this, our actions were retaliatory toward Mr. Wise and Ms. Waller.
And to the chairman's point with regard to some of these issues being initially addressed with a motion for reconsideration, that would have been a way in which to kind of vet some of the concerns we're discussing today.
Certainly, and again, if there had been a brief that was filed before this hearing, we could have vetted that also, and we would have been able to have more law to determine what the basis is for the issues raised in the notice of appeal. So that's why I'm saying we're at a severe disadvantage because neither of those were done, and that's part of my issue is that I'm trying to do, besides reading, going back over these pleadings, just from the notice of appeal and the decision, Judge Vonner, other than that, we're just acting on memory right now from something that happened almost a year ago.
Thank you. Chairman?
No. Mr. Reeder, thank you.
Yes.
And Mr. Pfefferman, 5 minutes.
Sure. So first of all, I would just like to discuss what the commission's role is here and whether or not some of the commissioner's comments about whether or not they can go back and sit in the shoes of the hearing examiner. I don't think that that's what this appeal is asking. I think this appeal is asking for a simple look at the record to see if there was any evidence or substantial evidence presented on the record to support those conclusions and findings that I've mentioned in the notice. The second thing I want to talk about here.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Did you raise bad faith below?
Absolutely.
And when, at what point in the hearing did you do it at the did you raise it at the end? Did you make a motion to treble at the end when she awarded the $9,000, but when did you raise the issue?
Bad faith was specifically addressed in my closing.
Okay.
And I don't so the okay. The I would like to address what we were talking about, that the facts here don't, the findings of fact don't rationally lead to some of the conclusions that she made, and I think some of that is evident in the single paragraphs that she writes for each one of these housing conditions. Sometimes she makes a finding of fact at the beginning of the paragraph, such as it was noticed on the punch list, and then she makes a finding of fact, a conclusion at the end that there wasn't any notice given, even though she makes a finding at the beginning that it's clearly on the punch list. And I think that happens over and over throughout those conditions. Lastly, I just want to, and this is, and I'll just stop after this, regarding the submission of a brief and the submission of a motion to reconsideration, I don't think that those are required by the rules. I don't think that that if you don't take those steps, that your appeal shouldn't be well heard at this level. I don't think
we were making that at all. Let me tell you my thinking on it, and it's just my thinking, is I think the benefit of a motion for reconsideration below is when there are factual disputes that are resolved for one party in a judgment that another party wants to raise again before the trier of fact and say, by the way, there was a lot of evidence here that you didn't look at to get, you know. Now, that's to the trier of fact who can then change that decision, that judgment, okay? We are in a reviewing mode. We can't change judgments, you know. We can't do the same thing as the trial judge would do in a motion to reconsider. That is, reconsider facts. Those facts are part of the record, okay? What we have to do is take a look at the record we have and say, okay, based on the record we have, absent the motion to reconsider, this is the full record. Is there enough evidence here to support, you know, our standards? We apply the standards. I don't think the failure to file means nothing to me in terms of, you know, it could have been done. Well, it wasn't done, but that means we're left with this record. So this is the cold record we're left with. Is it a procedural matter that one might consider? If we, for example, say, you know, you're asking us to consider a lot of factual questions, we're not the trier of fact. You could have raised this below, you didn't. We can't do anything about that, you know? We're not factual. We're not going to determine facts up here, you know? That would be the only way that I could see it, would be that certain factual issues that maybe needed resolution could have been done by the trier of fact, not by us. Okay, we're going to look at a record and say, did the judge make mistakes or not? Okay, that's my only point about that. You chose not to. It was a decision, you know. Typically, when there are a lot of factual disputes on appeal, in my experience, and we have a motion to reconsider, that shows another degree of consideration of these facts. Now we don't have that. We have just a record. That's fine. That's what we have to deal with. So, no, there's no penalty. I just asked you because it seemed to me if you have a lot of factual disputes, to me that was always the purpose of a motion to reconsider below, especially below, because that's the trier of fact. Do you see what I mean?
Well taken,
yeah,
yes.
I mean, you know, but it's no comment on. It doesn't put you at a disadvantage at all because we still have the record. Okay, we've got the record of the proceeding. Okay. Any other response, Mr. Pfefferman? Okay.
No.
Well, thank you both, gentlemen. We are. I think my colleague raised a very, very good point. We will, from now on, Mr. Rieger and Mr. Pfefferman, in our notices of these hearings, we will, or maybe even when the clerk of the court contacts you, we can add in what she tells you we'd like you to consider, because that has happened before. What my colleague has said has happened. Not necessarily rolling eyes, but it's kind of like, I didn't know we had that opportunity here. You know, and I know the Court of Appeals had trouble when they first started. You know, they made an announcement. I mean, we could announce it in the D.C. Register, I guess, that this is what we're doing now. And even though it's not exactly in the statute, it's an implied power. That's how they got it. That's how they viewed it. So, but thank you, Mr. Rieger, for that. That's good to know. And my colleague raised a really good point. And, sir, thank you for coming. It obviously is your stake in the matter. It's always good to see, you know, at this level, this is the appellate level, it's good to see people who take that kind of interest. So thank you for coming. And your daughter, hopefully, we don't have a playground, but we're working on it. So, all righty. Well, thanks very much, gentlemen. And it's not, what do you know, it's 3:00. Game over.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.